And we are back live on The One Show, 96.5 Inner FM. Matt sitting across from me here. Matt, you've got Blood Moon Wines, which for me, having tried most of them now, I think, apart from a Schiappatino, which...
The wine of the summer, apparently, according to Grab Magazine.
Always away, the ones that everybody wants sells out before they know they need it.
The one that got away, yeah.
So you've got a range of small batch wines from the Yarra, Sunbury, Heathcote, and they're charming, approachable, and really enjoyable young. How did that style come about?
I think when we first started making our wines, one of our prime objectives was to honour the fruit.
Yeah.
I've drunk a lot of different wines from all over the world over time, and I think we realised that one of the main things that Australia has to offer, really generally speaking, is great quality fruit.
Yeah.
Great conditions for growing good quality fruit in. Getting it ripe is generally not an issue. So, honour the fruit, that was the starting point. But, obviously we branch off into a few other avenues along the way. But, that's where that approachability comes from, yeah.
Yeah, and so what does that mean, honour the fruit? Does that mean you're not going to put it in oak for 5 years and, let it sort of stew in that kind of thing? Is it about doing not a lot to it?
Both of those things. It certainly informs the winemaking decisions that you make. Definitely oak is pretty much, we use just old barrels, really.
Yeah.
There may be one or two wines where I'll get a new barrel each year, and then that'd be a small percentage. But for the most part, 5-year-old barrels, so they're pretty neutral. They're not really offering any flavour.
Yeah.
They're just offering what storing in oak normally does, so that maturation that you get through a vessel that has a small amount of oxidation, but it's certainly no flavour addition. So you're preserving the fruit and treating it very gently, as you say, during the fermentation process. So not a lot of plunging, not a lot of real working with a plunger. Sometimes just with hands, just rolling the cap under.
You're doing it with your hands because, people get on the plank over the thing and, they're plunging with a big stick and you're just giving it a little massage. It's like Wagyu wine.
Pretty much, yeah, with the marbling. With different wines we go, say, 100% that way. So, I did a Nero d'Avila this year and that one I really just did once a day, roll the cap under with my hands. It never got plunged at all. So you're never really working the tannins out of the skins and you're never going to be breaking the seeds up, any stalks that are left in, anything like that. With a plunger, if you're really working it, you're pushing them to the bottom and you're breaking them open eventually, especially as the acids work on them over time. And so you're going to get all those tannins coming out. So you end up with a pretty soft wine and you're not going to get that interference, I suppose, in flavour-wise with the fruit. Some wines we go 100% like that. Others, I'll try and get the best of all worlds. So I'll do separate batches, like a batch that's, say, a whole bunch fermented, a batch that's whole berry, and another one where I do work it. And then you're trying to just build in a little bit of the benefit of working it, which can be, some length on the mid palate and a little bit of grip, that kind of stuff. So, but, it's just a question of how much. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Of course. And that's, but you have quite a range of, grapes that you work with. Is your winemaking style then influencing which grapes you choose to work with, or is that more a case of what's available?
What I choose to work with is more what I'm interested in working with, I think, and then depending on what the fruit, what it's like when I get it, I often make decisions. I mean, not to say that I don't make any planning at all, but you kind of have to be agile, to use the word yes, of the last decade. Hopefully that'll disappear in the next decade. But, you kind of have to work with what you've got as well. But as to why I choose to go with those varieties, it's probably just over the years I've thought, I really want to work with that variety or this variety. A lot of the Italian ones have come to my attention because they just seem to be a really smart choice for varieties to grow in Australia with reduced rainfalls, hot, dry climate. They're just perfect.
Well, it's true, and I bring this up all the time, but James Busby, he went through France and Spain, and a lot of the Spanish cuttings didn't survive the trip back. But if he'd gone to Italy, if only he'd gone to, Greece or southern Italy, Australia would be so much different, but also growing varieties which are less intensive for water needs and, you know, have grown up in the conditions that we have. So they do make sense.
Oh, absolutely they do. And if you, one of the other aspects of my winemaking is that I, to go back to your original question, is I don't like to do any additions if I can avoid it. So that includes acid, which is, I guess, one of the bog standard additions, really, just to correct pH and acidity levels. I tend to not do that if I can avoid it, which really means I've got to, with the fruit that I grow, I pick to avoid that need, so I pick earlier.
Yeah.
And I try to influence the growers that I'm buying from as well and say, well, don't worry about flavour so much, or the numbers so much. I'd like it to be a little bit earlier, even if it's only a few days, just to get that little bit of extra acidity. But these Italian varietals, it's often not an issue, especially Nero d'Avola. Like, it can be pretty ripe, and it's still got great natural acidity. So there's, with this one that I did this year, there was no question of adding any. There was just so much there to work with. And that's growing in a pretty hot environment.
Is that Heathcote?
That's a Heathcote, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so that's Charmer's fruit. But yeah, I mean, it is a really interesting variety. It has this capacity, like the stomata. So it's native, by the way, to Sicily, so it grows on the slopes of Mount Etna.
Yeah.
And apparently when it gets to about 42 degrees, the stomata in the leaves can sort of voluntarily shut down. So it's kind of, holding itself. And whereas a Shiraz would just go and respire until it dies, and then your vine is dead. Whereas the Nero can just hang on in there, shut down, and then restore itself when conditions improve. So it's perfect really for surviving those really tricky spiky days, you know.
One of my very first guests on the show when I took over was Brendan Carter from Unico Zello, and he grows Nero d'Avola in the Riverland, and he was saying the same thing. It just stops. It doesn't keep going. It sort of says, all right, it's too hot. It's a very Italian way of doing things, isn't it? Just when things are a bit challenging, you just stop and wait.
It's a cultural sort of influence on the vine, you think, yeah.
But amazing flavours too. So for people who don't know Nero d'Avola, how would you describe it?
Look, it's in that suite of Italian flavours and aromas. So you're looking at cherries and maybe plums, that sort of darker, ripe fruit, but really quite spicy as well on the nose. And quite soft, depending on how you work it, of course. Yeah. They can really blow out too. You can get some pretty big ones. But if you get it just right, beautiful balance of natural acidity and those kind of ripe cherry plum flavours.
And even I find some of them can be quite leathery at a young age too, which
they age really well.
It's quite endearing. You know, it's not just all fruit straight up. It's kind of, you get the benefit of, aging a wine without having to actually let it sit for five or 7 years.
An early sort of savoury character is good, yeah.
And what do you reckon it's most like for people who drink sort of the more French varieties?
Compare it to a French variety. I guess, what would it be like? Maybe a Gamay kind of, in terms of texture sometimes, but it's big, obviously much bigger than a Gamay. Just with that savoury element, so maybe a bit of a Cabernet Franc kind of thing in there as well. But the spiciness isn't really like anything that you get in France. It's like, once you get to know it, it's really quite recognisable, even amongst the Italian suite of wines, that it has quite a distinctive spicy flavour on the nose, or spicy aroma on the nose, I don't know. It's kind of in its own sphere, really,
It is hard to describe, isn't it, if you'll compare it to other things. And
well, it certainly sits within the Italian canon, if you like, but hard to compare it to something French,
It's not a variety that I've had terribly much exposure to.
Well,
you will have. I've got a bottle for you out there.
I'm excited to try it.
And you gave me a half a sample bottle that had been sort of shown around, and I took it home. Yeah. And it's a lovely wine, like you say. Sort of, power of acid, bright and fresh, and crunchy, but a little bit savoury and spicy.
So that would have been day two as well for you by the time you got hold of that. Yeah. So I often, if I've got something open for someone else, I'll just give Phil the rest because he works at a shop quite near near where I live.
Yeah, it's not because I'm desperate for wine. and yeah, that's how I've seen most of the range, in fact, is you're sort of dropping some bottles off. And the other one, and so I give you a bit of a hard time about it, but I'm interested in the variety Schiappettino. That's at the other end of Italy. And where did you get that from?
That also comes from Chalmers.
Yeah.
So Chalmers is, they have like 30 Italian varietals planted. I think they're up to 30. So I'm totally in support of that place. I just think they're doing great things. They were originally a nursery that brought in a lot of these varieties to Australia, and then they've moved into actually cultivating them and growing them.
Yeah.
And they make wines under their own label as well. But yeah, you can buy small parcels from them. Yeah, if you're lucky, you've got to get in the queue.
Yes, well, and there's a lot of wine that comes off their vineyards, like a lot of small batches, it seems, that people play around with. And I think it's an interesting model for them to raise awareness and allow people to sort of push the bounds of their fruit, because they obviously have their own style that they make wines in, and maybe they're more, you know, sort of assessing it in a more safe environment, whereas if other people buy it and they can push a boat right out, and see, then Chalmers get the feedback of what happens with their fruit.
And they're supporting smaller producers as well and allowing them to be a bit more experimental with their winemaking too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good relationship.
It's a win-win, I think.
Yeah.
And for them as well, it's exposing, you know, it's helping to make those strangely named varieties. They're not strangely named, but to us they seem that.
Yeah.
We just call the Schiappettino Skip in the winery, Skip. Or Skippy. Yeah. But if you see that written down for an English speaker, it's like, how do I say that? So you get every version under the sun.
Yeah. S-C-H-I-O. Yeah, and he's like,
keep going.
It's
double P and a double T in there. And
you almost need a phonetic sort of
somebody did
description
that
on the label.
There's a producer called Bike and Barrel who have a vineyard, and their Schiappettino has the phonetic on the back label, but it's such a long word. The phonetic is
it's really long.
But it's true though. And one of my mentors said the reason, actually a couple of people who taught me about wine said the reason people order a lot of wines, they think, is because they can pronounce the name, you know, and Chardonnay isn't that hard to get your head around. And it's so common you hear it becomes, you know, part of what you know. But then the minute you get a wine list and there's some really weird stuff on there, you can't do it. The first time I was putting out a bottle of Echezo from Burgundy, that's like E-C-H-E-Z, you know, I'm like, I have
so many extra letters that are just not pronounced.
How do these work together? Yeah. What is it? I just waited until my boss said the name and I'm like, oh, Echezo, yeah, that's totally what I would have said.
I do that
too.
I'm glad I'm not the only one. I was going to actually ask off the back of that, is this the first release of your Schiappettino?
The one that we're talking about, which is all gone. Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. There will be a 2020 version of it.
How have you found it in terms of, are people game to buy it based on it being kind of a obscure grape variety?
It took a little while to get going, I guess, but then it just went like hotcakes, to be honest.
Yeah.
The sort of I guess the high-profile Schiappettino, I mean, there's not much of it grown anywhere in the world, but the Italian one is one called Bressan, and he makes a style that is, by the way, he's quite a dubious character, so I do not necessarily endorse any of his political views. I'll just make that well known.
You just like his wine.
Well, it's an interesting wine, and he goes hard, and it's worked really hard, and it's then aged in barrel for 3 years, and then aged in bottle for, I don't know, three or four years before release.
Yeah, well.
So the last one I had was a year or so ago, and it was the current release was 2011. So they're really, really dense, savoury wines. You know, they're really trying to get rid of that old thing of get rid of the extraneous fruit. We'll leave it as long as it takes till the fruit's gone, and then we'll release it kind of thing. We went the complete opposite way. So ours was all about finding out where the fruit can go with that wine. That one we made at our, we have a little winery on one of the vineyards. It's pretty primitive there, so we treated it super gently, but the conditions are not like they would be in a commercial winery where you can really protect and look after. So it gets a little bit more oxygen, and it's basket pressed and all that sort of stuff. So it's the fruit, it is treated super gently, but it is a there's obviously a lot of flavour in that grape anyway, in the skins. Big bunches, actually, and big grapes. So I was surprised that the concentration of flavour was... Because usually small berries equals, you know, greater concentration of flavour. But no shortage of flavour and a really wide spectrum of stuff. But because we'd made it so light, you can chill it down. And that I think, was its main sort of vehicle for getting out there. And we decided... I don't think it had finished Malo. It was dry, but it was still pretty spritzy. And we just capped it and we put it under a crown seal in a clear bottle. So clear glass bottle. And it had a beautiful colour as well, which kind of glowed through that.
Yeah, cool. How much did you make?
Glass. Oh, we just did a ton.
All right, guys, we have to take a break. But before we do, we should say good morning to Christopher Robert Mullen, who's listening. When's the Nero Doublet released, Matt?
I'm going to take some photos to put on the website this week.
Yeah.
It's official. Like, I sold some this week.
Okay.
So it's out. I haven't done a big, you know, pop the cork. It's out, but it's out, basically. Yeah.
All right. So people will jump on the website. If Christopher jumps on the website, he'll be able to buy it. Or
later this week.
Shoot you an email and let you. All right.
Shoot me an email and we can sort something out.
Cool. In the studio with me, I have Matt from Blood Moon Wines and I have Tilly from Tilly J Wines. And we were just chatting about what Matt's been up to with Blood Moon Wines and some of the weird and wonderful varieties that he's working with. I have one more variety I want to chat to you about. Chenin Blanc. You're
putting that in the weird and wonderful category?
It's so old school. People used to drink that before Chardonnay. This was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And
a slightly different style they were drinking then, but...
Well, I was going to say, what I like about yours is it's a little bit Frenchy. It's got some texture and it's got that, you know, lovely acid and the pears, but it is not like an Australian Chenin Blanc as we know it. How did that come about?
Well, I'll begin by saying that year by year, that wine has been quite a different beast.
Okay.
Year by year. So I think you're probably talking about the latest one, the 2019.
Yeah.
Okay, so with that one, the yields were down about a third from the previous year. So this one I grow. So I grow vines on two sites. The other ones that we were talking about previously, I buy the fruit in. And I've been growing the fruit at this vineyard out at Sunbury for about 5 years. It's a pretty marginal vineyard, so I think the benefit of that is obviously your vines are really struggling, your yields are often lower than you would perhaps desire, but...
Just to explain marginal to us.
Okay, so rainfall is right at the cusp of what is acceptable. I don't like to irrigate.
Too much rainfall or not enough?
Too little.
Yeah.
Too little. So what was the national average this year? It was something terrible, like 275 or something.
Yeah.
That's millimetres over the year. And we get about 300 out there.
Yeah.
So it's not much. And the first couple of years, I didn't have to irrigate. We just got through. There is irrigation there, but it's on the reticulated town supply, so it's ruinous to use it.
Yeah.
But we have had to use it a bit these last couple of years, just to keep the vines alive, actually. It's been so dry. Anyway, the positive side of marginal is that you often end up with lower yields and quite concentrated fruit. Chenin Blanc, again, you get these big sort of bounteous bunches. But smaller the berry, again, better the flavour, if you're trying to get flavour out of the skin. So, which I generally try to do to a greater or lesser degree. So with this one, what I did was I picked about a third of the crop earlier than the rest and crushed it and left it on skins in a chiller for a little while and then out in ambient temperatures and then picked the rest of the crop about 3 or 4 days later. It's not a huge difference, but just meant that you've got that maceration happening and you're drawing a bit of flavour and a bit of phenolics out of the skins. And then I put all that together, so whole bunches with the crushed grapes into the press and then pressed it off to old oak barrels together. So you're getting a modicum of skin contact, if you like.
Yep.
And also just that few days gives it that little bit of extra acid as well, because it can really start dropping off pretty quickly towards the point at which the grapes ripen. I was lucky to find this site. I actually found it through a French friend who Tilly and I both worked with at
Ori
at Punt Road. And Ori had all these dreams about what he was going to do out at Sunbury, and he sort of drew me in, and then he nicked off to America to accompany his partner, who was becoming a burlesque dancer over there. Anyway, that's a whole nother story for another time slot, maybe. So I kind of inherited it if I wanted to keep going with it, and I did. There's Cab Franc out there as well, so there's a Loire thing going on on that side. Sure. But yeah, look, it's a tough site, and tough can mean you get interesting fruit coming off the site, you know, fruit that's packed with flavour. So then it's a matter of, you know, how do you use that fruit, and year in, year out, it's different. Acidity's never a problem, huge amount of natural acidity. The previous vintage, massive natural acid in it, massive natural acid left in the wine, but you should have seen what was left on the tank after fermentation. Yeah. Just the tartrates were just out of control. And in that particular vintage, what I did was I left a whole lot of solids in there. So when I racked it for final bottling, I literally just sucked up a whole lot of the lees and left it really chunky. And I just thought that added a layer of texture which kind of offset that massive acidity. It was a very lemony wine, but bringing in that those lees kind of brought in a briny quality and a savoury quality and a textural layer. So yeah, that's an example of how you're kind of working with what you've got each year. Yeah, but I love Loire Chenin Blanc.
Yeah.
So that probably informs some of my decisions. But then I just, you know, as you can see, I make decisions year in, year out.
Well, it's farming, isn't it? It's not.
Yeah.
It's and you can only definitely work with what you're given. You can't. I mean, you can try and influence it, but ultimately, is the fruit is what it is. You can't. You can only do so much, and then you start just making an artificial product, which has its other. There's another whole sort of series of problems with that.
Totally. I mean, as the farmer, you do have a bit more control, and you're certainly, you know, making the call on when you pick and when you harvest. That's definitely your call, and how you prune. So how much you're making the vines work. You're controlling your yields a bit by doing that as well. Like I said, I don't irrigate. Again, you're reducing the growth of the vines really. But maybe I should have done a bit more this year actually, because some of them are really really struggling.
So, Matt, we can find your wines and your story at bloodmoonwines.com.
Correct.
And there's online ordering and all sorts of information and beautiful pictures, and there'll be a Nero Davler up there soon for people to order. And if you're super keen, just send you an email. There's a contact form there. And
there is a contact form there.
Get in touch, and it is released. It won't come via Airtasker, though.
Or not with the sticker on the box, anyway.